Winning is an everyday mindset, and on the Ways to Win podcast, coaches Craig Robinson and John Calipari are here to help. Each week, Craig and Coach Cal use their on-court wisdom to solve off-court problems. They'll talk about the latest news in college and professional basketball with coaches like Jim Boeheim, former players like Stephanie White, basketball analysts like Grant Hill, and more. Revealing insights that made them into the leaders they are today. And don't miss President Obama, sharing how he deals with pressure by projecting confidence, believing in your team, and taking criticism.
You don't want it. You don't need it. But you're going to get it anyway. The Kevin Sheehan Show. Here's Kevin.
The show today presented by MyBookie. MyBookie is securing your first deposit bonus up to $1,000 if you use my bonus code KevinDC. Use KevinDC to secure your first deposit bonus of up to $1,000. That basically means that if you make a deposit into MyBookie of $1,000, they'll give you another $1,000 to bet with. So you'll have a $2,000 balance to bet with. Hockey playoffs start tomorrow. NBA playoffs next week, and plenty of UFC and golf and even NFL Week 1 lines are out there if you want to wager on those. Go to mybookie.ag, use my promo code KevinDC, and the best part about it, even if you've got another place in which you're betting, you're going to get an extra $1,000, or if you make a $500 deposit, an extra $500. Make a $100 deposit if you want, and you'll get an extra $100 to play with at mybookie.ag. Using my bonus code KevinDC. All right, on the show today, we are going to do some Washington football team to start with Ben Standig, and then Ben Raby, who is a part of the Caps radio broadcast team, will be with us to help preview the Boston Bruins Caps first round series, which starts tomorrow night. And then we're going to do a little bit of Preakness talk to end the show with a gentleman who's been pretty good at picking horse races and can tell us a little bit more about the Bob Baffert situation with his Kentucky Derby winning horse. We'll do that a little bit later. Ben Standig, of course, from The Athletic is with us right now. Subscribe to The Athletic. Follow Ben on Twitter. Listen to his podcast. Ben's always busy. So here are the topics for today. The schedule, the addition of Leno, some mini camp, and then how close are they? Let's go in order. What did you think of the schedule? What was your reaction to the schedule, especially the five games ending the season all against NFC East opponents?
Yeah, it's bonkers, right? To have that slate in a row, those are obviously every game is important relative to the overall record, but the division games have extra weight for the obvious reason. And the fact that, you know, it's one, like when we want to project the season out, obviously, as we saw last year, you never know how things are going to go, not just with your team, but the other team. So the fact that with the games that are the most important ones are at the end, and who knows what's going to be happening. Will they be hot? Will they have lost momentum when they're going through that gauntlet early on against the Mahomeses and the Rodgers and the Bradys? What will the injury situation be like for them or the other team? It's a pretty fascinating situation to see. It also means, of course, if they get off to a bit of a slow start because they have that tougher schedule early on, there's an opportunity to catch up facing the teams you have to battle within the division head-to-head. So it's really interesting, and you know, I don't know if I like it every year, but I think for a one-off at least, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, I've sort of decided here in the last couple of days that I don't like it. And the number one reason for not liking it is that it just opens up the possibility that your arch rival games, you know, several of them are going to be meaningless. I hope that's not the case, but it's possible that Washington's 4-8 or 5-7 going into those final five. Now, if they're 5-7, they've got a chance to make a big run, you know, over the final five. But, you know, in spreading them out more so, even when we've had years in which they've ended with, you know, three straight games against division teams, it means they've already played those teams three times earlier in the season when at least the season was still hanging in the balance somewhat. And I think a lot of fans, and I would put myself into this category, I've always looked forward to the matchups against the division teams, especially the Cowboy games for me over the years are always, you know, kind of special. Well, playing them twice over a three-game period starting on December 12th, I'm not saying that it's probable, but it's possible that none of those games are going to mean anything. I don't like that as a possibility. I would rather them be more spread out. I don't mind with them ending with Dallas, Philly, and the Giants, you know, in order. Or, you know, I would rather have it like Philly. I'd rather have it Giants, Philly, Dallas, something like that, to end the regular season. But knowing that we had the big, you know, Sunday night game in, you know, early September against the Cowboys and maybe a Monday nighter against Philly in October, something like that. Or at least the Thanksgiving Day game against the Cowboys. I don't know. I've decided over the last 48 hours that I don't love it. But whatever. I do think it's interesting, though, how many people I've talked to that sort of look at it and say, ooh, two home games to start. Great opportunity to get off to a great start against two average teams. Well, one of those average teams, the Chargers, is favored already in the opener against Washington. Did you get the sense sometimes that the people you talk to about the team don't really have a sense as to what the rest of the league and sort of the way they evaluate the team right now?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think one thing I've learned over the years is that when you listen to both national pundits and also just random whoever you people on Twitter or fans, you know, some blogger types, whatever it is, your perception of a team is often what the long-term one is, and you don't always catch up quickly. And, like, we're probably all guilty of that on some level when we look at other teams as well. And, yeah, when for example, with the Aaron Rodgers situation, right, I don't think he's going to get traded here. If for no other reason, they probably wouldn't want to move him in the NFC. But when you see people mention, well, what about Washington, and a lot of the pushback is, oh, God, why would he want to go to that terrible organization? Where are they going kind of thing? And it's like, well, okay, yes, the owner is still problematic, but obviously Washington did a lot of good things last year. The roster is pretty intriguing. What they've done in free agency on paper looks to be pretty solid. You're telling me if Aaron Rodgers didn't join what we have here right now, that they wouldn't be right vaulted into the top of the NFC conversation? Of course, but like that's not how people still view them. And look, they were 7-9 last year, right? Now, only those of us who are watching every week were like, hey, actually, they've won 5 of the last 7 and all that. But if you just look at it, you know, broadly, 10,000 feet, 7-9, it's Ryan Fitzpatrick. You know, they still have problems. You know, their ownership is still in the news constantly. It still seems like the same old, which on some big picture it may be. But yes, I think in the short term, I don't think people probably see the potential, not since they would win 10 games, but that the potential for this team to improve is there, whether everybody kind of sees it or not.
All right, we're going to sort of circle back to part of this conversation in a few minutes. But I'll ask you, what did the signing of Charles Leno, the tackle, for $5 million 1 year, what did it say to you about their state of offensive line, specifically a tackle?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think it says that they felt they needed more. I mean, they obviously didn't go and sign a tackle early in free agency in the first wave. They did draft Sam Cosmi in round two, but I thought that people were overstating, like, he would be the left tackle week one, you know, and talking to scouts and others. It's like, hey, we think this guy's interesting. He's athletic. There's definitely a lot to work with, but he needs more time to work on his sort of basic fundamentals and clean up some of his mechanics and things like that. So it never felt to me like he was a week one guy. And obviously, look, Cornelius Lucas was a guy who was brought in to be a swing tackle, who was projected to be much more of a right side guy. I think maybe to a degree they felt they were fortunate that he was able to hold up as well as he did over the course of the second half of last season, but that they needed more. So, you know, I think it says that. And I also think it says something about their level of patience across the board. We've seen this now, obviously, at quarterback, right? They didn't panic and go trade up just because everybody says that, well, they have to get a long-term answer. They didn't take a guy in round two if they didn't love him. They waited. And same thing here. They obviously thought they needed more at tackle, but they recognize there is more for agency. It isn't just those few weeks in March, that there is more opportunity down the line. And that's what they saw. The Bears drafted a tackle, then cut Leno to save some money on the cap, and they swooped in and got him. I'm not thinking Jacoby or Samuels or Trent Williams, but, you know, he looks like he's an upgrade over what they had. He was the left tackle when Lucas was in Chicago coming off the bench and ending up starting 8 games on the right side. So I think it probably says, you know, something about where those two guys are, that we feel, you know, there's already been a direct head-to-head, and Leno was the guy starting.
Never leave Jim Lachey out of a listing of the greatest left tackles in franchise history. He may be the most gifted and talented out of all
Absolutely.
Of them. Although Trent Williams was pretty talented. You did pencil in your story in The Athletic, if I recall, reading it the other day, Charles Leno is the starting left tackle.
I mean, I don't think that's much. It feels to me, it's sort of like the Ryan Fitzpatrick thing. Rivera will come out and say there'll be a competition and all
really?
That stuff.
Really? You think it's that definitive? Because Fitzpatrick's the starter. That's a 95% chance. 99% chance. You think Leno's in that same category as a starter at left tackle?
Well, I think I said, like, I think he's in the Fitzpatrick role, but slightly less forceful. Like, I mean, there's something about the money, right? Fitzpatrick is $10 million. Leno is $5 million. I don't think it's as like it wouldn't like completely floor me if he wasn't the starter, but they're bringing him in here to start. If you made them pick right now, he's the starter. I would very much think that's the case. He said that as much that they said to him, we want you to be the starter. Now, who knows what they really said or how he interpreted it or whatever. But and that's also like the narrative that was coming out immediately on the signing, when, from his side to the Schefters of the world, that they try to put that narrative out there. But yeah, in any event, like I said, I mean, just 2 years ago, he was the guy. Look, I guess if you tell me Sam Cosmi just blows everybody's mind, we could maybe have a conversation. But even then, I would be stunned if it's not Leno at left tackle.
Yeah, I don't think it's that high. By the way, I was talking to Keim earlier in the show. Keep in mind, the 1 year, $5 million for Leno, put that side by side with Eric Fisher getting $9.4 million from the Chiefs coming off an Achilles injury. I actually think Washington did pretty well. I'm not suggesting that at any point Leno's ever been the player that Fisher was. Don't get me wrong, but Fisher's coming off an Achilles injury, and they're paying him nearly $10 million bucks a year.
He's not supposed to be ready for week one, I don't think.
Oh, I didn't even know that part of it, which doesn't, you know, it sort of makes sense. I just think that one of the things that we've learned in the first year here with Rivera is, you know, take Sean Davis as an example from last year. They sign him, they give him guaranteed money. They give him $2 or $3 million in guaranteed money on a 1 year deal. And, you know, everybody pencils him in as the starting free safety opposite Landon Collins, and they cut him. So I don't think anything's, you know, obviously they're not going to do that with Fitzpatrick. But I don't think anything is solidified at left tackle like you do. I mean, I hope that Leno plays at that level and has that veteran experience and can play at the, you know, the level that when he made the alternate, you know, trip to the Pro Bowl. That would be awesome if that happened. Here's the other thing that I want to ask you about. I asked Keim this. To me, it says that definitively, Sadiq Charles is a guard, and that's the way they view him. Do you agree with that or not?
Yeah, the Sadiq Charles thing is pretty weird to me because, you know, on top of signing Leno and drafting Cosmi, they just traded for Eric Flowers 2 days before the draft. So let's just, in terms of 2021 solely, I don't think, where is Sadiq Charles playing? I mean, sure, if he comes into camp and he's the best guard, he could be the starter at left guard over Schweitzer and Flowers. I don't think that's inconceivable. But at the same time, now he's played 2 snaps in the NFL. The other 2 guys are far more established. And, you know, obviously Brandon Scherff, unless there's something afoot there, he's not, you know, Sadiq Charles isn't going to play. Now, of course, when you look to the 2022 season, right, Scherff, unless they signed the long-term deal, we all probably assume he's not back.
Right.
And at that point, I would think Sadiq Charles becomes the leading candidate to be the right guard, whereas at tackle, you would still have Cosmi and likely Morgan Moses, I would assume, on his deal. So, yeah, I mean, it feels like it's setting up for Sadiq Charles to be the 2022 starter at guard, unless he somehow, you know, really impresses everybody, which is conceivable. I mean, Rivera clearly liked him last year. He just couldn't get on the field enough. So I think that's conceivable uh, for for sure. And by the way, just on the Leno thing, like the thing that Rivera has done here is they have a lot of competition across the board. You can look at the offensive line, you can look at receiver, maybe a couple other spots where we can all assume certain things, but if somebody falls on their face, then there are other options. You know, and like Leno has been a more proven starter than where Sean Davis was at that point. I did think Sean Davis would be the starter when considering what was the other options. Like we said, Troy Apke and all. But obviously he fell flat. But Davis didn't come in with nearly the immediate resume that Leno did. It was more of a flyer, but I guess a lot of people did as well, that he would beat out Troy Apke, let alone make the team. They obviously decided to move on. But in this case, based on Leno having started every game for the last 6 years or whatever it is, that would just surprise me if they brought him in to then have Lucas start or anybody else start week one.
You did suggest something that I've talked about over the last week, and I'm not saying that you predicted it or said that it was likely, but in your a recent column that you wrote, and I think it was after they signed Leno the other day, you threw in just the possibility with all these offensive linemen and with Flowers and maybe Charles and others at guard about the possibility of trying to get more for Brandon Scherff if they expected to lose them than the team did for Kirk Cousins when they lost him. So do you think there's any chance that they deal Brandon Scherff before the season starts? Obviously before the trade deadline, if they are headed towards a non-playoff season, is very much in play. But you threw that out there, and I don't have the exact quote or the exact paragraph, but I did read your story, and you suggested that, you know, could be in play.
Well, I mean, like, to be clear, like, I don't have any intel that tells me. I mean, I have hopped around. I haven't heard anything that suggests there's trade whispers out there. But it just is a very weird dynamic. Like, so if you look at the, like, nine offensive linemen, keeping nine is a number that, like, a lot of teams probably end up with, right? So let's just say that's Leno. Let's just say, for argument's sake, Flowers, Ruye, Scherff, and Moses, okay? Then behind them, you have Cosme and Lucas. You have Sadiq Charles, and they'll say Keith Ishmael is the backup center. I'm forgetting somebody here that's pretty good. Who else am I forgetting?
On the offensive line?
Yeah.
Did you mention Schweitzer, Martin?
Oh, Schweitzer, right. No, yeah. Schweitzer. Forgot Schweitzer. So that's 10. Okay, so okay, 10 is not a crazy number. Now, the rest of the guys, now I'm not saying that Jaron Christian or Wes Martin are worthy of a roster spot, but like they were so the week one starters last year. You'd think they would at least be in the mix. They signed Tyler Larson, a guy who's been in the league for a few years, having played his entire career at Carolina. They brought him in free agency, a nothing contract, but regardless, they brought him in. They didn't do that on a whim. And then also like a guy like David Sharp, who they traded for last year and ended up starting a couple games when injury struck. Like, all those guys, I just said, have no prayer of making this roster, barring injury, as it's currently constituted. So I get it. Competition, competition, competition. But at the same point, they have a lot of bodies. Now, maybe that works out for their favor. Maybe when we get to August and other teams are starting to have issues, maybe they're the team that has access and can trade somebody and pick up a day three pick like they traded one away kind of last year with Sharp. They ended up getting one back, but they traded a sixth for a seventh or whatever. So I don't know, it just feels odd. And I guess the one variable we don't know is to what degree does Ron Rivera view it as, look, we're going to worry about 2021. He did kind of say this the other day, not about Scherff, but just in general, the idea of like, we don't know what's going to happen down the line. We're just going to worry about now. And maybe he says, screw it. We'll just play out this year. Whatever happens, happens. We'll deal with it. Or maybe he thinks, hey, we want to build this thing over the long haul. And over time, we need to maximize our assets. And we think maybe trading Scherff to get more things than, like, if the third round compensatory pick is the baseline and they can get more for that in a trade, and they don't think the drop off from Scherff to anybody else at guard, I mean, it's going to be significant, but they don't think it'll be so dramatic or it's worth the trade cost. Maybe. I would just like to know what he thinks about that. That's sort of the unknown variable here, is how does Rivera view all that. I mean, the most likely scenario is Scherff and Moses are on the right side, right? I think that's the easy way to go, and I would be stunned if it's not. But at the same point, man, they do have a lot of offensive linemen all of a sudden who are at least NFL viable. And it just makes you wonder to what is the point? Is it purely competition or is there something else?
I think anytime they probably would think about, okay, we can get more, you know, especially if a team's got a lot of cap space and they're willing to give him a long-term deal and he's willing to agree to it. You know, we could get a lot more now than maybe the compensatory pick. But I know this because I remember this at the end of the season, somebody telling me, you know, about the sheriff situation. Go back and look at what Aaron Donald did to the game that he played against us without Brandon Scherff there, and tell me if you don't think we need Brandon Scherff. Aaron Donald single-handedly wrecked that Rams Skins game. That was the game where Alex Smith was literally ravaged for 30 minutes in the second half. Kyle Allen got knocked out of the game, and Brandon Scherff did not play in that game. All right, mini camp starts today. The people that you talk to, who are, I mean, this is one of those things where because there aren't veterans and there are only 15 to 20 or whatever it will be of rookie players over the weekend, sometimes it's really hard to learn about what you have. But other than, you know, Jamin Davis, who do you think the staff is looking forward to seeing, seeing this weekend up close and personal as one of their own more than anybody else? Is there someone?
Well, I think it's going to be 16 players, which is obviously not even enough to do 11 on 11, even if you had the equal number of players on both sides and all that.
Right.
Plus, at the moment, you and I are talking kind of earlier in the morning, it appears that practice, whatever this is going to be, isn't even going to be terribly long. So I don't know what this is really going to look like. It's not the usual rookie camp where you have, you know, dozens of tryout players. They weren't even going to have that because of COVID, and then because one of the tryout players tested positive, the five that they had, those guys are not even coming. So I don't really know what we're going to be looking at here other than just a chance to see people on the field and get, you know, for the coaching staff to get a look at them in person. I'll tell you who I think one of the more intriguing players, to be honest, isn't even one of the draft picks. I think it's Samus Reyes, the tight end, you know, who they found in that international camp, because it is the epitome of the unknown. They have studied all the other players to some degree at length, right? I mean, whether you're talking about Jamin Davis on the front end or the Shaka Tony, one of the defensive ends they took in the seventh round. They've studied these guys. Samus Reyes kind of came out of nowhere, and that is a position where I have no idea what it's going to look like beyond Logan Thomas. We can presume John Bates, the fourth round pick, will also make the roster. I mean, that seems pretty safe assumption, but, you know, who knows what happens beyond that. So I think Reyes is a really interesting player because, I mean, I remember hearing about him before I even knew who he was. When I had a couple people in the league telling me there's some kid who looks like Gronkowski who's from some other country and look out for this guy. So I think that one's interesting. You know, beyond that, I mean, I think like, you know, I think De'Ami Brown and Benjamin St. Juice, the third round pick, like I think those are two guys who have a lot of intrigue that if things go right, they could be contributors pretty quickly. There's room for both of them as either the third receiver or the, you know, third, fourth cornerback to go, and they both have a lot of intriguing athletic traits. So I think those guys, to see them out on the field, you know, again, we'll see what this really looks like. But I think to see those guys on the field, you know, maybe we'll start to give the coaching staff a sense of how quickly those guys are able to contribute.
Just out of curiosity, I was just thinking about this. Who's the quarterback in rookie minicamp this weekend?
Steven Montez is going to be out there. He's one of the five. They have five guys who were with the team last year. He's the one. He's one that people would have heard of more or less. He's the quarterback. Of course, you know, I reported during the offseason that they're going to look at him perhaps in a bit of a Taysom Hill role, but at in terms of, you know, either making the team or whatever. But for now, I would presume, you know, they're going to look at him as, you know, a quarterback. They didn't draft one, obviously, so he's the project at that position at a minimum, and possibly having him do some other stuff. But again, probably not this weekend.
All right. Last topic with Ben Standig. So I got an email from a friend of mine. He's one of my, you know, they're like, I don't know, I bet everybody has this group of friends that you really think, at least among yourselves, you're having like really smart conversations about the football team or about the NFL. You know, there are definitely people in my life where it's like, oh God, I don't really want to have a conversation about the team with you, because I really don't think you have any clue as to what's going on. But that would presume that I have like a significant clue. And I think we all fancy ourselves, Ben would include that, to be, you know, sort of sharp opinion people on the team. But that's obviously a subjective thing. Anyway, this friend of mine, Zach, who, you know, appears in my life every year, you know, during football season or draft time, and we end up having these conversations, usually by text, sometimes by phone. He sent me this email, and he said, essentially, I'm just sort of sick and tired of your take on Aaron Rodgers. You know, I just think you're way off, and I'll just read part of what he emailed me. He said, Kevin, we're close, and your insistence that Aaron Rodgers be our quarterback will derail what Ron is building. Not only do you want to mortgage the future, you want to move us away from being close because you want players included. This is the closest we've been in 30 years. Good coach, good front office, great defense, veteran quarterback to groom maybe the future quarterback who might already be on the roster. Aaron Rodgers is a short-term solution to nothing other than a few playoff games and maybe a win or two. That's not the goal. The goal is winning it all. Keep building it the right way. We're, as your friend Bruce Allen would say, we're close. Or at least we're getting closer. First of all, I don't know how much of a friend Bruce Allen was, but he did say several times, we're close. Anyway, I know that there's been a lot of conversation among a lot of the people listening over the last couple of weeks, and there was a conversation right when the season ended on, you know, what the solution is at quarterback. You know, I hope there's at least a recognition from most of you that the preference would be to try to have a great quarterback on your team for like 10 years rather than just having a really good team and just sort of figuring the quarterback thing out at some point and hopefully having something that's satisfactory. That's not the path to, you know, 10 years of being a legitimate contender. You've got to have that position solidified. I think most people do realize that. But at the same time, Ben, when I did this poll last week about the Bill Barnwell, you know, putting Washington as the second most likely of the teams to land Aaron Rodgers if he's actually dealt behind Denver, and he said two first, two seconds, Matt Ioannidis and Ryan Fitzpatrick, I just was surprised that like 99% of the people didn't say, oh my God, let's do that. Can we do that now? 2/3 of the people said, let's do it now. But 1/3 of like 6,000 people that responded to this poll said no. And so the conversation has sort of continued. I don't really want to have a conversation about Aaron Rodgers specifically, but I want to ask you, and then I'll give you my answer afterwards. Do you think they're close? And if so, how close? Like, describe what that means. Like, how close do you think they are to legitimately contending for a Super Bowl?
So the position that we're discussing is the massive variable, right? Because this is why whatever quarterback you want to discuss, but Rodgers in particular, because he is that level. I mean, even more than like when we were talking about like a Deshaun Watson earlier in the offseason before his legal stuff came up, I wasn't as excited about that one because they were talking about trading picks for this draft, which they weren't. I mean, I know it's only been one draft and one offseason, but they're now closer in theory than they were earlier in the offseason because they've now made these moves and we've seen what they've done and they've addressed some areas of need. If you were to trade for Rodgers now and you're trading future stuff, even if you're trading Ioannidis, I included Daron Payne in the offer I made because I thought that realistically probably what Barnwell had there wasn't enough, but okay, whatever. Even still, like you now have these extra, you have this draft have had happen. We don't know what the future is going to hold. I think if you told me you add Aaron Rodgers to what this team is now, based on what our assumptions are of the young players and where they're going, I do think that they would be right there in the mix with whoever you think is the top of the NFC because Aaron Rodgers is that good. I mean, on the assumption that Aaron Rodgers, like everybody else, turns into a Ron Rivera fan. I mean, I don't know the fact they both went to Cal, if that helps the cause, but it can't hurt. And again, it's not like you would be bringing in Rodgers to the football dysfunction that was going on here for the last decade. That, I would think, would be a mistake. This feels different. And like I said, if you're trading away a player, pick whichever defensive lineman you think would need to get the deal done, if that's where we're going, and future picks, how much are you really messing with this team right now? Especially if it's a defensive tackle, whichever one you think. Like, they that's a position to actually have significant depth. So I don't think they're close as it stands, meaning I think they could get to maybe 10 wins or something, but I don't necessarily put them in the top tier with what they currently have. You tell me Aaron Rodgers is the quarterback? Yeah, that's a whole other deal. And to your friend Zach, who I'm sure is a nice guy, feel free to email me at bstandick@theathletic.com because your take is nuts. They should be exploring this hypothetically if Green Bay is even willing, which I doubt they are, but if they're even willing, because Washington has done enough, and Rivera, both as from a culture perspective with Rivera and the other thing. And by the way, I don't even think you're sacrificing that much of the future. Like, let's just say it is 2 ones and 2 twos. That's not nothing. All right, don't get me wrong. But you still have a lot of other picks. This isn't the NBA where if you're trading with all your first round picks, you've got nothing, because there is no other draft. You still would have all your other picks, and you can make other moves to acquire other picks or whatever. So it's not like they're just giving away everything. Look at the first and second round picks we've had here the last few years. Have they all worked out? No. So I don't think it's that crazy at all to get a guy like Rodgers. He is that much of a difference maker. You know, other players, maybe not him. Yes.
They're not close right now, because if you look at the NFC, Tampa Bay, Green Bay, Seattle, the Rams, and even the 49ers are all demonstrably closer to being in a Super Bowl than Washington is. I just gave you five teams. Now, that assumes Rodgers stays in Green Bay. And then I can give you another four that you could debate are, you know, on par or have a better chance or are closer: Dallas, the Saints, Arizona, and Minnesota. You could certainly debate that those teams are closer. So I just gave you a list of nine teams. I'm not saying the last four that I just gave you that you couldn't debate that Washington is closer than those four teams, okay? You can. I'm just saying that it's a debate. It's not a lock. That puts him at, you know, number six best case scenario, which is not close to contending for a Super Bowl, because that's barely close enough to contending for a wild card spot and being in the postseason. And potentially, you know, I've got him, at ninth or tenth among 16 NFC teams. By the way, that's exactly the way the handicappers in Vegas have it. They basically have Washington's over-under total for wins coming up is like ninth in the NFC, and their odds to win the NFC championship like ninth among 16 teams. So that's not just my opinion. That's the opinion of the odds makers, you know, in every place where they make, you know, futures odds on the NFL. If you put Aaron Rodgers on the team this year and gave up the two first, 2 seconds, and Matt Ioannidis and Ryan Fitzpatrick, Washington is the second pick to win the NFC championship. There's only one team, and that is Tampa Bay, that is ahead of them. Everybody else, Washington, basically moves in front of. So we're talking about, like Kime said to me this morning, he goes, look, you accelerate it with Aaron Rodgers. You accelerate the closeness. And I said, no, you do more than accelerate it. You guarantee the closeness. And nothing else that you can do right now or for the next couple of years gives you the guarantee that Rodgers would give you, which is you become immediately an NFC championship going to the Super Bowl legitimate contender, a top two contender. So I don't get any of you that say that you wouldn't do this for the building it right, whatever the hell that means. Build it right, and in 2 years we'll find the quarterback. Good luck with that. I do think, and it sounds like you think the same thing, maybe you wouldn't describe it this way. Tommy described it as malpractice if they're not aggressive going after Rodgers if he's actually available. I agree with him. Now, not landing him isn't malpractice because they don't have total control over it. Like you said, and I agree with you, if he does get traded, I think it's going to be to Denver. I think they're going to want to move him to an AFC team, not an NFC team. So I think the hype hypothetical on Rodgers is a long-reach hypothetical. I agree with those of you who say that. But the point is that if he is available, I want them to be super aggressive going after it in sort of the same way, but even more so than they were with Stafford.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, like, one thing that always happens in any of these conversations is when we start talking specifics, people get hung up on that versus the philosophy behind this. Like I said, I wasn't that excited about the idea of trading for Deshaun Watson, but in part because there's no chance they were going to get him. Even if they were willing
Zero.
To trade 3 1s and 3 2s, seems like the Jets and the Dolphins had much better ammo.
And he had a no-trade clause. He had a no-trade clause, so he could dictate where he went.
Right, but I'm saying even like beyond just that aspect,
sure.
just there were other teams that had way better opportunities to get him. This is different. The playing field is much smaller. It's sort of like when we talk about when there was a point when everybody was saying the Wizards have got to trade Bradley Beal, and then once the season started, I'm like, why would you trade him in the season? You're limiting the amount of teams. There's only like a handful of teams that could even do it. If you wait till the offseason to do it, the whole league is essentially now open for business. It's the same thing now, but now in reverse. You're the team. You're one of the few teams that would actually make sense to make this move. So you're working against a much smaller group of competition. I know in theory everybody would say, well, let's go for Aaron Rodgers, but most of the league has some form of quarterback or they don't have the stuff. I mean, one reason why Washington could make this hypothetical trade is they actually have depth at this defensive line position, particularly inside, that if they use Barnwell's idea of Ioannidis, like, I'm not discounting Ioannidis, who led the team in sacks in 2019, but, like, you know, would you even notice it to that extent? Barring injury, I don't think so. And yeah, like you said, look, Rodgers is, you know, whatever he is, 37, about to be 38 or so on. Like, that's obviously not – that's way up there, and who knows how much more time he has. Of course, we now have seen other quarterbacks, Tom Brady most notably, but even Drew Brees, play well at an older age. And Rodgers is showing no sign of slowing up. Again, he just won the MVP this year. So assuming that he is mentally there and not actually viewing this Jeopardy thing or anything else as something he legitimately wants to do now, he's going to be here for a few years. And while I completely agree with Washington's decision to not – draft a quarterback, totally agree. There's more opportunities. There's no guarantee that you will get somebody, right? There's no guarantee even if you trade up for Justin Fields, he turns into anybody good. I know Aaron Rodgers is an all-time legend.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't even understand the debate.
Coming off an MVP
right
season.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. I mean, yeah, he's right. At least with even like with Brady, it's sort of like, well, you know, I think Brady's still really good, but to what end? He wasn't as, you know, New England this last year was kind of, you know, a little whatever. And then last year, obviously, he played really well. Rodgers is already playing really well. So, yeah, I mean, to me, it's more about the philosophy of it than it is the specifics, because I don't think it's likely that he actually gets moved or comes here. But, yes, I absolutely do not view that they would be mortgaging anything to trade him. And if anything, it would put them in position for the first time in how many years to contend. That's not nothing. And by the way, if you're the organization, this isn't Rivera's issue per se, but if you're the bigger organization, you want people back in the stands, go get Aaron Rodgers. You haven't had any excitement
imagine?
Around here.
Yeah.
You haven't had any excitement around here for several years now. People have been, you know, miserable about this team. And even if there's a little more positive vibes now, it's not, you know, it's not at a rock star level.
Yeah, and don't give me the Donovan McNabb comparison, you know, in terms of marketing angle. Lastly, if you could give me, you know, just sum it up in, you know, 60 seconds or less. You had a source that told you about Snyder's involvement or lack thereof during the draft.
Yeah, I mean, when we saw the TV go to the Washington's draft room, there was no Dan Snyder, which is unusual based on history. He is typically front and center with a cigar hanging out in the mix. Obviously, maybe some years more than others, he's pushing certain theories or certain plans as to what he wants, i.e. Dwayne Haskins. But he was not there this time. And what I was told was that, yes, Ron Rivera let Dan Snyder know what their plans were before the draft, and as they went through each time, whether we're making picks or contemplating trades, that Dan Snyder was, you know, informed, but was not pushing for anything particular. That he was, he heard what they were looking to do. He seemed to be, if I say accepting of it, I don't mean it like he was begrudging, but like he seemed to be okay. That makes sense, and kind of moved on. And ultimately, this felt like a Ron Rivera controlled draft. And obviously that's kind of what you want. Obviously you want the football people making the football decisions and not the owner, who's shown no capacity for doing that successfully over his time. So all that seems positive. I always go back to, of course, what somebody told me right at the point that Rivera got hired and started saying all the nice things, was that, you know, Ron Rivera has not yet met Dan Snyder, that Dan Snyder is good at the beginning of relationships, but give it time. So we'll see what happens over time. But as of right now, and I think this has been borne out based on everything we've seen, this is Ron Rivera's show right now. Plus, obviously, as you've discussed 100 times, Dan Snyder is dealing with a lot of things off the field that I'm sure is focusing his time and to some degree dealing with, you know, whether you're drafting Sam Cosmi or Davis Mills in the second round is probably not high on his priority list. So, you know, he's not as focused on those things, I would guess. But to nonetheless, it wouldn't take much to just jump in and say, no, this is what I want. And apparently he did not do that.
Interesting. No Beth Wilkinson report or update to that story in the last few weeks. Thank you, as always, at Ben Standig on Twitter. Subscribe to The Athletic and read Ben on The Athletic. And listen to his podcast, Standig Room Only. You can get it anywhere you get a podcast. Have a great weekend. Appreciate it.
Absolutely, man. Thanks.
The NHL playoffs start tomorrow. Caps Bruins tomorrow night, game one at Capital One Arena. Ben Raby's been doing the pre and post game show for Caps Radio for a long, long time now. He'll be our guest next, right after this word from one of our sponsors.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Tomorrow night, Game 1, Caps-Bruins, as the NHL playoffs are here, about a month after they usually start, but obviously the weird year that we've lived through, the 56-game schedule, and here we are in sort of a revamped division situation. They're going to play all the teams in their division. That's all the teams they've played all year long, and they have already seen the Bruins 8 times this year, and now Game 1 tomorrow night at Capital One Arena. 25% capacity, I believe, to start these playoffs at home, game one tomorrow night. Joining us on the podcast is Ben Raby. Ben Raby is in his 12th season of hosting the pregame show, the postgame show, all the intermission stuff on the Caps Radio Network. Ben, thanks for making time for me. It's such a weird thing, you know, the whole season this year and the schedule where they played just the teams in their division, and some of these teams weren't even there in their normal division setup. I actually had Brendan Dillon on the radio show this morning, and I said, you know, this is strange. You know, your first-round opponent is a team that wasn't normally in your division. They were this year. You've already played them 8 times. Is that a help or a hindrance? I mean, they're very familiar with these teams. How do you follow this sport? You've watched it. It's a weird thing we're getting ready to embark on, isn't it?
Yeah, I will say, Kevin, it finally took the Capitals and Bruins being in the same division under this unique format this year to meet again in the playoffs for the first time since 2012. And what I mean by that is in the 9 years since, there's been opportunities for these teams to meet potentially in an Eastern Conference final or deeper in the postseason. A case could be made. The Capitals and Bruins, Kevin, these have been among the class of the Eastern Conference really for the past decade. And here they are. It took them being in the same division to finally cross paths postseason time. And
regarding the eight matchups in the regular season and the other night, the dress rehearsal, the regular season finale, that was a little bit of a farce in terms of who wasn't in the Boston Bruins lineup. They sat 16 regulars. But as far as any familiarity, I will say, Kevin, that the Bruins really the last month have been a little bit of a different team than what the Capitals dealt with earlier this season. And what I mean by that quickly is they're very healthy, and they made a couple of key acquisitions at the trade deadline, former league MVP Taylor Hall, part of that group. So it's a team in Boston that's, you know, the cliche is playing their best hockey at the most important time of the year as they get set for postseason play. But that rings true for Boston. The past month, even with that defeat the other night in the regular season finale, a 12-4-1 record, and that record is a good indication of what the Capitals will be facing starting tomorrow night.
You know, you're now like the third or fourth person that has sort of, you know, indicated, and we'll get to your prediction, but has sort of indicated that this isn't the best of matchups necessarily, or from the timing standpoint may not be. By the way, you mentioned the game, you know, the series in 2012. That, of course, was the Joel Ward game winner in overtime of Game 7, which was a thrilling series and such a thrilling ending and so memorable, you know, especially given what he was going through in that particular city with that, you know, very harsh fan base.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because that series, and you mentioned off the top, my 12th season here, part of the radio team, that series, 2018 is kind of its own chapter, but that series in 2012, I've maintained, has been one of my favorites over the past decade plus in the Ovechkin era here. A reminder, 7 games, all 7 were decided by just one goal. It was the first time in NHL history a series had gone the distance with all 7 decided by one goal, 4 of them beyond regulation. Fittingly, Game 7 went to overtime. Joel Ward, the game-winning hero in that game. But, yeah, that was a terrific series. A couple of holdovers since then, but for the most part, plenty of fresh faces. But it that series was terrific. And also, Kevin, when you talk about the matchup, and maybe this not being the best matchup for the Capitals in terms of Boston, I'll say that in terms of how well Boston is playing of late in terms of, again, being healthy, whereas the Capitals have some question marks with their lineup. Stylistically, though, I actually think this is, I wouldn't say a great matchup for the Capitals, but it's two teams that are very similarly built. There's a combination of size and heaviness and high-end skill. I think for neutral observers, you know, across the country, if you don't have a dog in a race here, it's just a terrific, this should be a really, really good, entertaining high-end series here.
You know, when you mention there are just a couple of holdovers, obviously Alex Ovechkin and Nicholas Backstrom are two of them. And I'm wondering if you believe that there's a sense of urgency right now. You know, Ovechkin's obviously not been healthy. He got some on-ice opportunity in the season finale the other day against the Bruins. Hopefully he's healthy. Hopefully he's Alex Ovechkin in these playoffs. But he is 35 years old, and, you know, you've got the two, you know, guys that have been around forever here. And do you think there's any sense that they better get something done here in this postseason because the window is closing? And I know we've said that before, and then they won the cup in 2018, but, you know, it's a banged up year for him in particular, and others, by the way, on the roster. I want to get to that in a moment. But what do you think the team feeling is about this postseason as it relates to those, you know, legendary players?
Yep. Kevin, I think when the Ovechkin and Backstrom era ultimately comes to an end, and I don't want to over-dramatize here, but I think right now one of the more under-acknowledged storylines with their tenure, you think before the Cup, before 2018, they had missed opportunities, President's Trophy winning teams that came up short in postseason play. I think one of the under-acknowledged stories over the past 2 years since they won the Cup is the early playoff exits they had in 2019. And last year it was unorthodox, it was a bubble, et cetera, but they didn't show themselves well at all in last year's playoff run. And what I'm getting at is you win the Cup in 2018, maybe it buys you a couple of years from the fan base, from the marketplace, there's this honeymoon period, et cetera. I really think the past 2 years, when all is said and done years from now, I think you can look back at how well
Backstrom and Ovechkin played in 19 and 20 in those seasons. And those were real missed opportunities by the team as a whole, organizationally. And now you get to this year where they are banged up, where you do have an inexperienced goaltender, where you do have a very difficult first-round opponent in the Boston Bruins. And I'll continue to come back to the fact that I really believe 19 and 20 were missed opportunities to maybe have gone deeper and given yourself the opportunity for another cup run. And now I do think for that reason as well, yes, there's urgency this year. But I keep coming back to the fact that the previous 2 years, the missed opportunities, that's partly what makes this year even more urgent. And you just hope for their sake that, you know, health-wise and the question marks that are surrounding the club, you know, they are ultimately able to answer.
That's a really good point because, you know, if let's just say they had beaten Carolina in 2019 as the defending champs and gone out in the next round or the Eastern Conference Finals, and last year they didn't go out meekly to the Islanders, which they did in five games, but they advanced and they lost in the next round. It wouldn't have felt the last 2 years like it was a return to previous form. You know, losing in the first round in a seventh game in double overtime to Carolina, you know, after having a series lead, sort of felt like, you know, same old, same old. And I think if they had advanced further in the playoffs, even without winning the cup, there might be a different sense of urgency. I think that's a really interesting take, and I think it's accurate. But with that said, because of the last 2 years, there is a bit of urgency right now, and and the fact that Alex may actually be getting old for the first time.
Yeah, and I mean, I've learned you never count him out, that's for sure. I'm curious to see how he handles the start of these playoffs, just because what he's gone through just over the past few weeks is literally unfamiliar and uncharted territory for him, to have missed 7 out of 8 games down the stretch due to injury. He had never missed more than 6 games in a single season due to injury. He's missed games for personal reasons, league suspension, etc. But as far as missing that many games due to injury, and the fact that it was down the stretch and they were competing for first place in the division, home ice advantage, in other words, there were things at stake, and they were severely shorthanded around Ovechkin. And if there was any way he could have played, I'm sure he would have. He tried to that one night against the Rangers. He only lasted one shift. That's the only ice time he had over that 8-game stretch before finally getting back on Tuesday in the season finale, which was good to see. So I'm curious to see how he shows himself here in the first round. I'm sure the Boston Bruins will introduce themselves and use the body and try to affect Ovechkin in that manner. But, I come back to the fact he showed himself well each of the two previous springs. And I hope he can this year again, and I hope for his sake his teammates are along for the ride, whereas in the previous two springs they weren't all on board.
So who is going to be on board, healthy and ready? I mean, what's your guess on Oshie, on Carlson, on Kuzi, et cetera? Like, I mean, they could be hurting here, you know, entering this series.
Oh, for sure. Well, I guess you could say there's almost different tiers of them. John Carlson has acknowledged himself. He's good to go. Who knows how close to 100% he is. He missed the final 2 games with this nagging lower body injury, but he's good to go. He'll play. He'll be back on the top pair, I'm sure, with Dmitry Orlov. He'll get his allotment of minutes. TJ Oshie has been on the ice this week, so that's an encouraging sign. I'm not sure that he'll be back for game 1, but the fact that he's been skating, took part in limited drills with his teammates, that at least suggests, it's just speculation, Kevin, but that at least suggests probably within a week, if not the start of the series, perhaps as the series gets deeper and shifts to Boston, the fact he's on the ice, that's a good sign for Oshie. All right, Kuznetsov, this is a whole other story here, Kevin.
Explain everything right now for everybody that...
I don't know.
What's the reaction from teammates and the hardcore fan base about the Kuznetsov situation? Are they getting tired of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long story, is a long explanation, but the brief, the background here is, again, second time this season he's been placed on the COVID list. The first time in late January, he tested positive for the coronavirus, and he had symptoms, and he acknowledged he was not in good shape, and he was off the ice, out of the gym for 3 weeks. It took him a while to get back. So you wonder, how is he on the COVID list again now, and should mention the NHL's definition of COVID list. There's different reasons you could be on there. Could be a positive test, could be exposure to someone who tested positive. There's various reasons you could find yourself there. But the point being, it sounds like there hasn't been a clear explanation, but you read between the lines. He and Ilya Samsonov at first were not suspended, but they were not dressed for a night by the team for breaking team rules. The company line was they were late to a team meeting. This was with just over a week to go in the regular season, and the next day they're placed on the COVID list. So it would suggest that there was something off the ice behavior, you know, were they breaking rules, et cetera, and here they are on the COVID list. The antenna goes up, Kevin, when it's a player like Kuznetsov in his seventh full season with the team at the NHL level. This isn't a rookie. This isn't a kid on an entry-level deal. He's the third highest player on the team. He's such a key cog and valuable piece to the team when he's on his game, which is a big if, but when he's on his game, he's so tremendously valuable. And for a player with that experience, with that resume, with that position in the team's depth chart, for him to be making decisions like that, that put the whole team, you know, it affected the whole team down the stretch with so much at stake down the line, it's a head-scratcher. And it's not good. And the second-year goaltender in Ilya Samsonov is along with Kuznetsov. When you try to build a culture and all those buzzwords, it's disappointing when such a valuable piece to your lineup, again, puts the whole team in a difficult spot. Didn't only affect him. There was a trickle-down effect. They were so shorthanded down the stretch. Not a good look. And who knows when he returns, because in the meantime, he still hasn't been on the ice as of this recording.
What's your level of concern about the lack of playoff experience, the lack of overall experience of the two goaltenders who will likely play for them in this series?
Yeah, and we'll see if Samsonov plays.
Right,
that's
true.
That's a big if right there, because, again, he's been off the ice, and he won't even have the opportunity to do a conditioning stint in Hershey like he did weeks ago, you know, months ago when he came off the COVID list. Hershey's season ends this weekend, so I don't know what they're doing with Samsonov, what the plan will be there. I think you ride with Vanacek now, and you have a veteran in Anderson to back him up. As far as the inexperience, we'll see how that plays out. I just think more the eye test, Kevin, is that Vanacek has been a good to very good goalie during the regular season, just not great. If you follow, and that's just eye test, some numbers support that as well. He was sort of middle of the pack in the NHL rankings as far as the typical save percentage, goals against average, et cetera. But sometimes in the postseason, you need a goaltender to steal a game or two. And we'll bring a full circle now. We brought up 2012 against Boston. Capitals had an inexperienced rookie goaltender named Braden Holtby that spring.
Right.
And granted, it was a very defensively minded team with Dale Hunter behind the bench.
Right.
The team was laying out and blocking shots galore. But Holtby was
Ovechkin
was
didn't love that.
Yeah, no, he didn't love being a plumber. That's
no.
True. But Holtby, I mean, there were nights Holtby was stopping 40-plus shots in that series against Boston. I referenced four of the games went beyond regulation. He was making 40-plus stops a night, Holtby, in that series. He was excellent. It was his coming-out party. And you need a goaltender to do that, to bail your team out from time to time, especially in postseason time. And what I'm getting at is in the regular season, I'll say we didn't necessarily see enough of that from Vitek Vanacek consistently enough, coming up with the big save at a big moment. You know, there's an unforced error, a turnover in front of him. Barry Trotz used to use the expression, the best goaltenders are erasers. They mask what takes place in front of them. And Vitek Vanacek, there was just a yearning for a little bit more of that separates the great goaltenders from the very good ones, the great ones that can really, you know, again, bail the team out, come up with big saves at big moments, keep your team in a game, maintain a late lead. And here's hoping Vanacek has that in him come postseason time. He's earned the right to be the number one because of what isn't here right now, what isn't available. And, you know, here's hoping, again, he could take his game to another level now, because I think they'll need him to.
The last 2 years, we've already talked about the last 2 years and the results. And, you know, we could do probably a half an hour on what would have happened had Barry Trotz been the coach instead of Todd Reirden in those two follow-up years to their Stanley Cup year. That aside, what is going to be the difference, the noticeable difference to, you know, the fans that tune in more this time of year than during the regular season between Laviolette and Reardon?
I just think that the team has dealt with a lot this year, from the injuries, from the absences due to COVID reasons, from a lot of different issues that they've been forced to deal with, the inexperienced goaltending tandem. And through it all, look, when the dust settles, they were still competing for first place at the end of the regular season. And I think a lot of that credit has to go to the head coach, just in terms of not letting this get off the rails when it could have throughout the year. And the other thing I think you'll notice, we saw it plenty of times in the regular season, and again, it's such a buzzword, but that accountability. And if you're not performing, if you take a bad penalty, if you're underachieving, he's not afraid to sit you. It doesn't matter the name on the back of your jersey. And when I talk about in the previous two springs, there have been passengers, there have been players who didn't live up to their expectations, because Kuznetsov's part of that. Jacob Verana, who was traded weeks ago to Detroit, he underachieved in the previous two springs. If there are headliners, even, who aren't at their best on a given night, their minutes will be managed, their minutes will be monitored. Peter Laviolette isn't afraid to ride players maybe lower down the depth chart, maybe don't make as much money. And that takes an experienced head coach sometimes to make those decisions. He hasn't been afraid to do that in the regular season. I don't anticipate that changing now in the playoffs.
All right, last one, and I will let you run. You've sort of, you know, given us a tell on what you think of this series to a certain degree because of the way the Bruins have been playing more than anything else. What's your prediction and why?
Well, it's a tough spot here, Kevin, working with the Capitals radio network. I'm sure you
Well, I mean,
that.
And I can appreciate that. But what's your gut tell you about how this series plays out?
My gut tells me it's going to be a very difficult challenge here for the Capitals. I think the Boston Bruins right now, the way they're playing again with an optimal lineup, we saw a little taste of it in the next to last game of the regular season series they had. They met on a Sunday, I think April 18th, give or take a day or two, and the Boston Bruins truthfully gave the Capitals the business that afternoon. A 6-3 win at TD Garden for Boston. It was just the start of this run I'm referring to since the trade deadline over the course of the last month, and I think to that end that the Capitals will have their hands full. If the Capitals are to win the series, I think one of the areas they'll be able to potentially take advantage of, the Boston Bruins, they're a physical, they're a high-skilled team. I wonder about their back end. We didn't talk about Zdeno Chara being in Boston.
Right.
If there's one thing the Boston Bruins maybe lack this year, is that size, is that physicality as far as their blue liners are concerned. And the Capitals have some big boys up front. And if they can use that to their advantage, sometimes easier said than done, but if they could get in on the forecheck, if they could use the body, if they could make the Bruins' blue liners, relatively young defensemen, feel the wear and tear, that's potentially something as the series goes along, games 4, 5, 6, 7, you begin to reap the benefits. I think that would be among the recipes for success if the Capitals are to overcome some, you know, challenges which we've acknowledged are in place entering the series.
Ben, thanks. It's great catching up. Continued success. Hope you're well. And let's hope that there's a long run over the next couple of months and we can talk again soon.
Hope so. I'll say real quick, Kevin, oftentimes Stanley Cup champions find their toughest hurdle is the first round series. Without looking too far ahead, I think I'm implying that could be the case here. I think this is a tough challenge, but you kept past this. Look forward maybe to a deep run. So appreciate it, Kevin.
Well,
thank you.
Remember, they lost the first two at home to Columbus the year they won the Cup.
Yep.
And it didn't look good there. Thanks, Ben, so much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Kevin.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
The Preakness is tomorrow at Pimlico. Still not sure, and there's not a lot of clarity around when it will eventually, if ever, move to Laurel. But Pimlico tomorrow. Here we are, second weekend in May, and it's Preakness time. But a lot of controversy surrounding this Preakness because of what happened to Bob Baffert's Derby winner, Medina Spirit. Here to talk about that and also to preview the Preakness tomorrow is Eddie C. Eddie C. Is at It's Me Eddie C. on Twitter. He's a local, grew up in the area, went to good counsel, now spends a lot of his time picking winners. And Eddie C. is joining us here on the podcast because I really am, I'll be honest with you, it's not been like a priority for me in recent years. You know, I'll get to like 5 o'clock on a Saturday, on Derby Saturday or on the Preakness Saturday, and especially if there's a Triple Crown possibility when we get to the Belmont, and that's when I start to tune in and I'll watch the race with, you know, family or friends or whatever, and maybe lob a last minute wager in on it. But what's interesting this year is what happened at the Derby with Bob Baffert's horse Medina Spirit winning the Derby, and then all hell broke loose. So for those that are just starting to pay attention to this and may not pay attention to it really until tomorrow, what happened with Baffert's horse Medina Spirit after the Derby, and why is it being allowed to run at tomorrow's Preakness in Baltimore?
Hey, Kevin. First of all, appreciate you having me on. So, yeah, you know, the interesting part about the Kentucky Derby was, you know, this horse Medina Spirit ended up going gate to wire. And prior to the race, a few weeks before that, he was diagnosed with basically a skin rash. So the veterinarian prescribed an ointment, a cream, that contained betamethasone, which is a legal drug. But what has to happen is prior to the horse racing, there has to be no trace in the bloodstream. So depending on, you know, with the cream, it's a lot less an active ingredient than some people get injected, because it's also used for as an anti-inflammatory, pain relieving, joint, you know, relieving type of ointment or injection, so the horses can run pain free. Anyhow, so what happened with this is after the race, you know, they always test all the horses before the race and then after the race. They take blood samples, in some cases urine samples as well. What happened with this is, the interesting part is, he tested negative before the race but tested positive after the race. And then on top of that, you know, the vet never really disclosed to Bob Baffert what ingredients this ointment had in it.
Right.
But then at the same time, this is the way I look at it, is if you're the trainer, you know, and in a sense, I look at it as a parent with a little kid, you know, with little children, you're 100% responsible for their actions. So as a trainer in the horse racing industry, you're 100% responsible for what you're giving your horse or what your assistant trainer or your staff is giving your horse, be it feed, be it medication, whatever it may be. And for not to look at the ingredients on the label of that ointment and see that that's in there, because they treated that horse every day for 2 weeks leading up to the race. And that's why it became a positive. Now, the reason that they're letting him run currently right now is, whenever they do testing like this, they do what's called split samples. They always take two samples. You know, it's similar to what they do, you know, when they test people in baseball for steroids and football and stuff like that. So they always take two samples. They send one sample in. If that comes back positive, then the second sample gets tested. And they're hoping that it comes back negative. But my guess is it's going to come back positive.
Okay. So I get what the issue is. I get your skepticism in terms of Baffert not, you know, at least inquiring and knowing what was in the ingredients of the ointment that was used. What about the sport? Do they believe Baffert, who denied knowing this and denied doing anything wrong, or not?
Okay, so I mean, if you, Bob Baffert is looked upon as one of the greatest trainers, if not the greatest trainer of all time. You know, he's won, I think it's 6 Kentucky Derbies. You know, he's won 2 Triple Crowns in the last handful of years. You know, he's taken, I think, 5 or 6 horses that have won the Derby and the Preakness into the Belmont. And, you know, obviously only 2 of them won the Triple Crown, but, you know, he had 4 other chances to win it. So he's a tremendous trainer, but he's also got a history of violations to him. So there's many people in the industry that are just tired of it. There's actually a group of horse racing Twitter that are boycotting this weekend's Preakness from a betting perspective. And I'm not talking about huge whale bettors, but I'm talking about a lot of people. And when I say a lot of people, probably 400 or 500 people that are boycotting this Preakness. And they're also making an effort in creating a group of people to try to get the horse industry to clean up its act and basically ban Baffert for life. I don't know if that's going to happen. But, you know, Baffert's had his chances, and, you know, he's taking the stance. It's a lot of people referring to him as almost like the Lance Armstrong of horse racing now, because he keeps denying, but he keeps getting caught. So I like Baffert. I think I've always thought he was good for the sport, but, you know, you're kind of running out of chances when you get down to it. You know what I mean?
So with respect to this horse, it'll get tested before the Preakness, right? If there's any of, you know, that disallowed ingredient or component to the ointment used to treat the skin rash, if it's still in the horse's system, the horse doesn't get to run tomorrow, correct?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a possibility of that happening, to be honest, because they were probably treating the horse with this ointment up until this past Sunday, because they didn't realize that there was a positive test until Monday morning. So if, in fact, they did test this horse, if, in fact, they were giving this horse the ointment, the pre-race test most likely is going to come back as a positive. And if it comes back as a positive, I don't see how they can allow the horse to run. But, again, I'm not sure that they were treating the horse with the ointment, but, yeah, to answer your question, if the horse tests positive, he won't run tomorrow.
One last thing before we move to the race tomorrow. So he's been able to get Medina Spirit into the Preakness. What is the status of the win at the Derby? It was erased, right? I mean, is he suing? Who was the Derby winner?
Okay, Medina Spirit, as of right now, is still the Derby winner. The horse that came second is called Mandolin. If they strip Baffert and Medina Spirit of the victory in the Kentucky Derby, then Mandolin will be promoted up and become the winner of this year's Kentucky Derby. The negative to that, and this is another part of you know, horse racing Twitter that's kind of in an uproar about this, is that, you know, a lot of people had winning tickets
right
on that, the second place horse.
Right.
And they get nothing. They get nothing for it. You know, their ticket, they may as well just burn it, because even though there's talk about doing a class action lawsuit and trying to get money for it, I mean, it is what it is. You know, I mean, they've already paid out all the winning tickets. They're not going to pay out a second.
Right. What is the liability? What's the liability on a race that's been called as final results, payouts for win, place, show, etc. made, and then the horse is defaulted after the fact and you end up with a different order of finish? Is there any liability, or does it say it somewhere on the ticket that, you know, this is for the first, you know, final results announcement or something like that?
You know, I believe on the back of the ticket, there is some sort of disclaimer that covers that. I don't know factually because I don't have one in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Kevin, I think a way that you and your listeners can maybe understand it a little bit better, you know, how many times do, let's say, watching, you know, be it our Washington football team or any other football game in the NFL, and at the end of the game, there's a terrible call that changes the result of the game, and they send, you know, that team sends a report to the officiating office of the NFL, and then they come back and say, yeah, the refs were wrong, but it doesn't change the outcome. You know, you still lost, you know. So it's the same thing in horse racing. I mean, it's like, well, we've already paid out the winner, and even if we DQ this horse, we're not paying you out for the second place horse who we ended up promoting as the winner.
Wow.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about the Preakness tomorrow because Medina Spirit as of now is in the field. The horse is the favorite. Typical, right? Big field in the Derby and then a much slimmer field in the Preakness. You're really good at doing this. This is Eddie C. All right, Eddie's a local, and Eddie is out of South Florida now, and you can follow him on Twitter. It's me, Eddie C., to get his picks and to follow everything that he tweets about. But he's pretty good at this. So size up the field. Who do you like?
Okay, well, I mean, you know, the field, as you look at it right now, you can almost say that it's a 10-horse field, but you can look at it and almost saying it's a match race of the two Bob Baffert horses. You've got Medina Spirit, who's coming off the win in the Kentucky Derby. And then you have this his other horse, which is called Concert Tour, which is the 10-horse. And just for people to know, Medina Spirit's the 3-horse. But Concert Tour would have probably been the favorite in the Kentucky Derby. But, you know, he came out of the Arkansas Derby, and Baffert said that, you know, he wasn't happy with the way he came out of it, so they skipped the Kentucky Derby with him, pointing him to the Preakness. So, and they're clearly, by looking at past performances and everything, they're the two best horses in the race. So, but, you know, at the same time, I'm also looking for value. So it looks like Medina Spirit and Concert Tour are going to go to the front, and they're going to run, they're going to try to run 1-2 all the way around the track. But if this other horse, which is called Midnight Bourbon, which is the 5-horse, he's got some speed as well. And if he pressures them, the three of them could go really quick. And if they go really quick, they could tire themselves, burn themselves out, which is going to give an opportunity for a nice price horse or two to come in and maybe steal the victory. And I'm looking at a couple of horses that have a really good chance. I like this horse called Crowded Trade, the 4-horse. You know, I mean, it's a well-meant horse. They paid $185,000 for him, and he's well-bred, and he's also trained by one of the best trainers in the country called Chad Brown. And he's being ridden by one of the best jockeys in the country called J.J. Castellano. And this horse is a fresh horse. He's only raced 3 times. He's training really, really well. And he's had a month and a half off to prepare for this race. So he definitely is capable. And he's also a closer. He's going to sit off the speed. That's what it means. He's going to sit off the speed, and then he's going to give one run, you know, turning for home, and maybe he gets there. And then another horse is called Rombauer, and Rombauer is the 6-horse. And this is another horse that is going to sit a little further back and make one run at the end. In his last race, which is a race called the Bluegrass in Keeneland, Kentucky, he ended up coming in third to the horse that ended up being the favorite in the Derby, Central Quality, only by like 5 lengths. But he got a terrible trip. He got bumped at the beginning and was kind of boxed in for a while until he could finally get out and make a run. So, you know, again, looking for value, Rombauer is 12-1. crowded trade is 10 to 1. And again, I'm just looking for value on it because when you look at Medina Spirit, who's 9 to 5, and Concert Tour is 5 to 2, if it's those two people, if it's those two horses, I should say, you know, if you're looking to make some money, you're not going to make a ton of money on those two horses.
Right.
But they are the two horses to beat.
And they're the speed horses as well. So it sounds to me like, you know, those three horses, Midnight Bourbon, Crowded Trade, and Rombauer, especially considering, Eddie, that you said earlier that you wouldn't even be surprised if Medina Spirit got scratched, that's where you're sort of looking right now as sort of a sharp pick.
You know, in big races like the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, and the Belmont, there's always what they call a wise guy horse. And the wise guy horse could be Rombauer, who's 12 to 1. And then all of a sudden, when you turn on the TV tomorrow afternoon, Rombauer could be at 4 to 1 because the wise guy money's going on that horse.
Yeah, yeah.
It happens in all, and you've seen that.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's what you by the way, that's the information that I want more than anything. I want your prediction on where the wise guy money's going, and you think it'll be Rombauer. And obviously, if Medina Spirit is scratched, you know, Rombauer potentially, Concert Tour is probably going to be the favorite at that point, but Rombauer might be the second pick at that point based on what you're telling me right now.
Very well could be. I mean, I think Midnight Bourbon could be bet down a little bit. And there's one other horse that's worth mentioning. It's the 8 horse, Unbridled Honor. He kind of freaked his last race. It was running in the mud and on a very wet, sloppy track. And ran a great race. And from a performance and figure perspective, I mean, he came second, just missed by a couple of lengths, but he was closing fast at the end. And that performance was much better than any other race that he's ever had. So the decision from a handicapping perspective is, do you look at this horse and go, well, he just really liked the wet, sloppy track, and he's better on that type of surface than he is on a fast, hard dirt surface? You know, that's where you got to kind of make a decision. It's like, well, I like him as an improving horse because he's a young 3-year-old and maybe he's just starting to figure it out. Or do you just throw him out because it was a wet track and he's not as good on a dry track? And just to throw something out there on a different note, Kevin, if I may, you know, the shame of this whole Baffert Preakness thing is, you know, probably like you, when we were in high school and in college, you know, we used to go to the Preakness, go into the infield and with a bunch of the buddies and have been.
Yeah.
What's that?
Oh, boy. I was telling my youngest son, who's been, I think, the last couple of years, and I think last year or the year before, came back covered in mud, hammered, the whole thing. And I told him before, I said, you know, these will be great memories. I think I went like 5, 6, 7 years in a row or something like that. But that infield at Pimlico for the Preakness is a basic, at least back in the day, was an anything-goes environment. I mean, there was no law on that infield, and it got ugly at times. And I don't miss it at all, but go ahead.
Oh, I mean, it was like Woodstock in Baltimore is what it was.
And yeah.
Now, fortunately for me, I never did the Port-a-John hop, you know, so to speak. So, you know, I never crashed and burned doing that.
But, yeah, I passed on that too. But, you know, I do remember catching a graze of a punch thrown in the general direction of somebody that it was intended for, and all hell broke loose. And there was nobody really there to sort of referee it. It was unbelievable. Anyway, so go ahead, finish up your point. I'm sorry.
Well, I guess the point that I was trying to make was, you know, Jim McKay has so much to do with the history of Maryland horse racing.
Right.
And he did so much. I mean, his stamp is on Pimlico. It's on the Preakness, and it's on the Maryland Million, which was actually his dream, which is a series of races.
Sure.
It's just Pimlico. Just they always seem like the forgotten one, and the Preakness feels like the forgotten race of the Triple Crown series, and it's a shame because the history of Maryland racing, for people that don't know, racing started in Maryland.
Sure.
It didn't start in Kentucky. It started in Maryland, and it's a shame that we can't kind of take that back up and put it in the limelight and shine a bright light and a positive light on horse racing by going back to the roots of Maryland and Jim McKay.
Agreed. Really appreciate the time, Eddie. Follow Eddie C. on one of his two Twitter handles. It's me, Eddie C. He also has another Twitter handle, at Notebook Picks. All right. You can follow him in both of those spots. He's a local. He does this. He does this well. Thanks for the information, especially on the Baffert stuff, and good luck tomorrow.
Hey, Kevin, really appreciate the time. And, you know, hopefully if all goes well, we can do it again for the Belmont.
That'd be awesome. Thanks, Eddie. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Kevin.
All right. One more segment, and it deals with some very disappointing news related to Maryland basketball. That's next, right after this word from one of our sponsors.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What an off-season for Maryland basketball after losing in the second round to Alabama in the NCAA tournament after a real overachieving season last year in what was a loaded Big Ten. Obviously, the big news of the off-season was Mark Turgeon getting a contract extension. And then you had major transfers. Fats Russell from Rhode Island and Cutis Wahab from Georgetown and even Ian Martinez from Utah. I mean, Maryland's transfers in are leading towards a lot of discussion about Maryland being a preseason top 10 kind of a team next year. Now, Aaron Wiggins and Eric Ayala and Daryl Morcel, I think all three of them potentially could be back. Certainly Aaron Wiggins is going to test his NBA draft potential. I think if he doesn't go in the first round, I think he's back. And unless he has a Kevin Huerter kind of NBA draft camp, he will be back. And it's crucial that he comes back. I think Eric Ayala will be back. I think there's a chance that Daryl Morcel will be back after sort of testing the transfer market and maybe even the draft. And then there was some disappointing news that came out yesterday. The Big Ten basketball schedule for the 2021-2022 season was unveiled in terms of the teams that everybody's going to play against. It'll be a 20-game season. It's an unbalanced schedule. You play some teams once, other teams twice. And, of course, one of the wishes for Maryland fans was a home game next year against Michigan. Why? Well, the last game they played against Michigan was the dust-up between Mark Turgeon and Juwan Howard, all instigated by the freshman Hunter Dickinson, who was an outstanding player for Michigan all year long. And Michigan destroyed Maryland in their first two games and then had that quarterfinal game in the Big Ten tournament in which Maryland had a lead in the first half. And the game, you know, was there, you know, to be had at times, but Michigan pulled away. That was the game in which Smith went for like 18 points, and I think it was 15 or 16 assists in that game and was outstanding in that game. Anyway, with the back and forth between Maryland and Michigan last year, again, all instigated by the freshman from DeMatha, Hunter Dickinson, who claimed he wasn't recruited by Maryland, which he was by Maryland, there was some hope among Maryland fans that, hey, you know, for the first time, there's actually a team that we don't like, and for whatever reason, they don't like us. I mean, they handled us last year, but they seem to be obsessed with Maryland and Maryland's fan base. Certainly Dickinson did. You know, he mocked Turgeon in that first game on New Year's Eve in College Park. And there was a hope that Maryland would be able to host Michigan in this upcoming season. It would be a heavyweight matchup, and there would be sort of a bloodlust in the crowd for the first time maybe since they were in the ACC. Well, they don't get Michigan at home. That's the disappointing news. 20 conference games next year. They'll face several teams twice: Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Michigan State. I sort of view Michigan State as the games that I'd like to look forward to, and I'd like to consider them at some point a rival. Northwestern, Ohio State, and Rutgers, those are the teams they'll play twice. They're going to play Minnesota, Penn State, and Wisconsin just once at home, and then Michigan, Nebraska, and Purdue, they'll play just once, all three of those games on the road. Purdue expected to be a contender, Michigan a contender as well. So that's disappointing that you don't get that game against Michigan at home. It wasn't done on purpose. I think there's a sort of a rotational thing as when it comes to the scheduling. But that would have been a big-time game at Xfinity Center if you had, say, two top 10 teams, and what went on last year would have been quite the scene in College Park. By the way, the other day, Andy Katz did his Big Ten early sort of predictions, and he essentially picked Maryland to be the Big Ten champion. He had them as the early front runner to win the Big Ten. Had Michigan 2, Purdue 3. Again, those are two teams they play only on the road, Maryland does. Ohio State 4, Indiana 5, Michigan State 6. That's how Katz had it. Katz made it very clear that, you know, Wiggins returning certainly is key to that. But if Wiggins, Ayala, and Morsell come back, Maryland will be the preseason Big Ten favorite in a league that will, once again, on paper, it didn't perform in the tournament. But as far as a regular season league, it'll be a brutal test, 20-game test next year. All right, that's it for the day. Enjoy the weekend.